This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, another Democratic proposal to repeal HB 2, and there's confusion over whether the governor supports it. Charlotte Mecklenburg schools find themselves experiencing deja vu in a controversy over a book. Republicans in Washington are finding a repeal and replacement of Obamacare difficult, but several North Carolina lawmakers are playing important roles in that move to repeal, and a CMS high school student must leave the country. Will he take a diploma with him? Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more, and they are Tom Bullock from WFAE News. Glenn Birkins is here. He's editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Morning. Also with us, Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And rounding out the panel, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer at the Charlotte Business Journal.
Good morning.
Morning. You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook, or you can get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks using the hashtag WFAE Roundup. This is the first anniversary of the passage of HB 2. We've developed a musical sounder now when we talk about HB 2 going forward.
We've been saying we needed that.
The station spent no money on this sounder, I promise you. There have been.
It sounded so dynamic, though.
Yes, it's the Huntley Brinkley Report opening. Thank you, Mayton. Well, there have been a few repeal requests.
No royalties for Beethoven.
None at all. Yeah. There have been a few repeal requests and attempts, one of which we'll talk about in a moment, but some believe that this is the first of possibly several anniversaries. Governor Roy Cooper says that the longer it stays on our books, the more difficulty we will have in repairing the damage. And there are those in the legislature who either disagree or don't care. So are we just wasting airtime continuing to talk about this? Is this never going to change?
Well, I've said this before, and I'll say it again. The longer we wait to see a change, the more difficult it is for that change to take effect, because inertia pushes political poles away from each other. They become more entrenched. But we are seeing some movement, and there was even talk on Thursday, which is the official birthday of House Bill 2.
Happy birthday to you.
That's something. Something was in the works. And there seemed to be. And you saw some movement from Governor Cooper on Wednesday evening, when he actually said, hey, you know what, I could support a so-called cooling off period, which would be a period of time between when House Bill 2 would theoretically be repealed and cities and counties or whoever could pass their own expanded non-discrimination ordinances. And then you had House Speaker Tim Moore come out and say, really warn North Carolina representatives that Thursday's session could be super long, that they could even be in for a, unusual Friday session. So we sat there just kind of on pins and needles thinking, huh, something's going on. Long Republican caucus meetings for the House. Everything seemed like it was working up to something. At 12:30, the House starts late, but they start their session and there's nothing. Not a single word about HB 2 was uttered. So the anniversary came and went, and the law is still on the books.
So there's a lot of stuff that's been going on. You referred to what the governor said, and here's what he told WRAL-TV in Raleigh.
I think it's clear that we've got to compromise. And my principles have been that any compromise that gets us toward eliminating discrimination while bringing back the jobs, the sports, and the events, that I'm going to be for. And I think that a repeal with some type of short, definite moratorium would be something that I could support.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but did that come in response to the fact that at some point in time this past week, Mecklenburg County State Senator and candidate for Charlotte Mayor Joel Ford put forth his own proposal for repealing HB 2, which would also, in his proposal, establish a cooling-off period. That cooling-off period would mean that no municipality at the end of the HB 2 could pass its own ordinance like Charlotte's without waiting for a period of time. And the governor seemed to be on board through that comment, and suddenly the governor is not on board with that. What happened?
Well, I think what happened there is maybe he really was. I mean, Joel Ford says that – claims that – and this is Senator Joel Ford, which is he's a Democrat from Mecklenburg County, mm-hmm. who, as you said, Mike, is running also for Charlotte mayor. He said he accused Governor Cooper of moving the goalposts, of being ambivalent to repealing House Bill 2. Pretty serious charges for his fellow Democrat, especially when it comes to the most controversial law on the books in the state. And he, Joel Ford also accused Governor Cooper of changing his mind after talking with an LGBT group that same day. What's interesting here is the governor's office has come out and said no such conversation took place between the governor and Progress NC. And then you also have Cooper's statement saying he could, in fact, support this. So maybe the two just had a differing opinion. Maybe there was some misunderstanding. But it sounds to me like Governor Cooper is, in fact, supporting this idea. And it's also worth noting, this idea is not originally Jill Ford's.
It's Phil Berger's.
It's Phil Berger's, exactly.
That's right.
And Phil Berger described this as being like an old car, that you think it's going to start and then it doesn't. And then you think it's going to start, and then sometimes it does start, and then it stops. And
Phil,
that seems to be a rather apt description
yes,
of what's
Phil,
been going
and
on
Phil
here.
Berger has accused the governor of moving the goalposts. Is the governor moving the goalposts?
Well,
time we get close to something, he changes his mind?
Wait a minute. Let's back up.
All right.
Other people have been moving goalposts. Remember that
true, yes.
Last year, throughout the year, there was constant there were constant assertions by Republicans that if the Charlotte City Council were to repeal its ordinance, then there would be a clean repeal
yep.
of House Bill 2, a clean repeal being just a repeal, no other conditions attached to it. Well, in December, the Charlotte City Council, it took them two swings at it, but they finally did repeal the ordinance. And, of course, there was the failed special session, and now we are where we are. But none of these proposals in the last few weeks or since this session has begun are clean repeals. They are all
contingent
upon a moratorium or a referendum or
well,
something.
Let's talk about this moratorium that Senator Ford suggested. Is this not almost identical to the one that was presented by the Republican legislature
yes.
earlier?
One key change, and that key change is it is a definite period of time. Under Berger's plan, okay. It is conceivable that the General Assembly could have used procedural measures to indefinitely extend that moratorium. Senator Ford's plan says, I believe it's 90 days.
30 days.
I'm sorry, 30 days.
Yes.
Boom. That's it.
30 days after the end of the session.
So what's wrong with waiting for 30 days after the repeal of HB 2 for Charlotte or Greensboro or Raleigh to decide to pass another ordinance? What's the objection?
Well, I think that's where you get into some of the advocacy groups, Human Rights Campaign and Equality NC, who are saying that this has gone on long enough, there is no reason to keep stretching this out. And, of course, they do have influence with Democratic lawmakers.
And Joel Ford says this change in the governor's opinion occurred after he met or had a conversation with Equality NC, which is an LGBT rights group. Berger has said in the absence of some sort of compromise, there will be no repeal. So did that in fact happen? Did he have this conversation, and did they twist his arm and he changed his mind?
As I said, although I did misstate it and said Progress NC, it was Equality NC. The governor's office has no such conversation happened.
Okay.
And the other pressure we've got going on us, of course, is that the NCAA has finally come in pretty solidly and said, you know, we're looking at these tournaments through 2022, and they've said we're going to announce on April 18th, and we're going to make the decisions next week.
Yes,
so I guess when we play the HB2 theme song next Friday, we'll know whether they met that deadline. I wouldn't bet a lot of money on yes.
Yeah, they've given them a hard deadline. Has this done anything in Raleigh with this hard deadline?
You know, again, legislators and people around legislators are talking, but nothing's happening. So, you know, the only thing we know right now is that the road to the Final Four does not go through the state of North Carolina.
Well, so, and I have to believe that if we miss that deadline, that we're in for a long mm-hmm. wait to repeal this. I think this is one of the most important reasons to and one of the most pressing immediate concerns. Once we miss that deadline, what else is out there that's going to compel
Credit
lawmakers?
Suisse. Credit Suisse is out there, according to the Business Journal, right? Yes.
Oh, and don't forget, we'll be losing another NBA All-Star game here soon because 2019, you're going to need about a year lead time, so that will be coming around the bend. But that's not going to convince anyone. I mean, I think that...
But isn't that the big hammer? Isn't the NCAA and the ACC the hammer?
The NCAA, I think.
The NCAA is the biggest hammer. The NBA, no. But even... The NCAA, I mean, look, we've watched a cycle go through. It was in Greenville, South Carolina last week. I mean, yes, media talked about it. Some people talked about it. But there wasn't a great popular uprising. So I don't know if that's enough to tip the scales either.
Well, but as you reported, or somebody in the Business Journal reported, Credit Suisse is evaluating a plan to move a lot of high-paying jobs from New York to the Research Triangle Park. And the sticking point is HB2.
But Mike, you know what? I spoke with Tammy Fitzgerald from the North Carolina Values Coalition yesterday, and Dan Bishop, who wrote House Bill 2, is the primary author. And they both mentioned a statistic that is making the rounds with HB2 supporters, which is $500 million, the estimate of how much has been lost in the past year, is 0.1% of the North Carolina economy. And so they look at that and say, is it really hurting?
And they look at it and say it's not hurting our constituents, because most of this pain, let's face it, is happening in urban areas.
Yep.
And that is not those are not the areas that are being represented by HB2 supporters.
But we're the economic engines.
Yep. I will also say yes to that. But here's the thing. And actually, it's you know, Dan Forrest went to Texas this last week, and Texas is considering a similar law to HB2. And he was out there saying, hey, guess what? It only costs – he also quoted the 0.1% of North Carolina's economy. And it is true that North Carolina's economy is over – the gross domestic product of the state is over $500 billion – or sorry, 50 –
510 billion.
Yeah, 510 billion.
But now the flip side is that
you're still talking about between $500 million and $600 million in a year of losses to the state's economy because of a single law.
Right.
Which is really surprising.
And yet there's a letter, I think it's a letter to the editor in the Observer today or yesterday, that said North Carolina continues to grow by leaps and bounds. Obviously, HB2 is not keeping people away. Anne.
Yeah, I think we could be looking at seeing this shift almost from an acute illness to a chronic condition. You start hearing people talk about the Confederate flag in South Carolina, where they were under an NAACP boycott for 25 years. And it was not until the Charleston shooting that that actually was resolved.
What was
this
impact?
Could become just sort of part of the background of our state's economy.
What was the impact in South Carolina of that NAACP travel ban, essentially?
I don't have a bottom line impact for that. I have anecdotal examples of organizations and individuals who boycotted South Carolina. Frankly, I discovered the North Carolina mountains during that boycott. My family used to go to the South Carolina coast every summer.
Mm-hmm.
But after the boycott, we discovered the North Carolina mountains. And I know other families who found alternative places to vacation.
Okay. But, the other thing here, Mike, is when we get into this conversation about the economics of it, one of the questions I would pose is, what politician out there would say, hey, I would like fewer jobs and less money coming into the state? I mean, yes, there is an argument that it's not toppling the economy, but anytime you're taking away jobs and spending, that's not a good thing.
So meanwhile, Tom, this week there were meetings in the legislature, and you did a story, I think, this morning on one of those things that are going on behind the scenes, and talked about talk to Tim Moore. Tim Moore talked to you, or you played a cut.
Tim Moore talked to a group of reporters in Raleigh. And this is what's interesting. This came after the heels of the great anniversary where nothing happened and everybody thought something would happen. And, you know, Tim Moore has basically given this weekend – a homework assignment this weekend to House Republican caucus members, and that is to consider some kind of a plan. Now, what that plan is, we don't have a ton of specifics, but this much we do know.
We're not backing off of that. We made it very clear that when it comes to, you know, men being in changing rooms, showers, you know, for these facilities, we're not backing off of those privacy issues and that's not changing. So if there's any entity out there, whether it's a sports league or somebody else, that it's going to tell North Carolina that we have to let men in women's showers. That's just too bad. We're not going to change that.
So basically what Tim Moore is saying, changes to House Bill 2, possibly repeal? Nope.
Well, we don't have a sounder for the CMS book flap, but we will come back and talk about that in just a moment on the News Roundup. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Core 365, directly serving Charlotte organizations since 2008 and offering comprehensive information solutions including document scanning and shredding. Detailed information at cor365.com. And Sanger Heart and Vascular Institute, part of Carolina's healthcare system, offering comprehensive heart care, including the region's only minimally invasive heart bypass option and heart transplant center. Well, a new president, a new governor, and a lot going on politically. Democrats intend to filibuster the president's Supreme Court nominee. North Carolina Congressman Patrick McHenry has had his hands full trying to whip up GOP support for the Republican health care plan in Congress. Meanwhile, a Charlotte Democrat, is finding it rough going in repealing HB2, while Roy Cooper's first veto is overridden. All this is going on. We'll talk to three political scientists about what it all means Monday at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the fate of the GOP health care bill, the Trump camp, and Russia. London terror Neil Gorsuch. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The news roundup continues with On Point following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE News. Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com. Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer at the Charlotte Business Journal. And Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. How nice of you to be here, because we're going to talk about a controversy over a book that CMS has found itself in. 10 years ago, something similar happened, and it was a book about gay penguins. This time it's a book called Jacob's New Dress, about a boy who dresses as a girl. Why did the system want to use this book in elementary school, and who made the decision?
Well, it appears now that who made the decision was a committee of teachers and counselors who were responding to this longstanding, sort of working its way through the system, Office of Civil Rights order related to sexual harassment. So first of all, they are required to have lessons preparing students to avoid and deal with sexual harassment and bullying. Not an easy task when you have to prepare a lesson for first graders.
Mm-hmm.
But why they went with a book that is a lovely little story about a boy who likes dresses and wants to wear a dress to school, and it kind of talks about how he gets picked on and how his friends and his parents and his teachers support him. How that relates to a lesson on avoiding unwanted touches is not really clear. So it kind of became...
But it's also about bullying.
It is about bullying, and that's kind of what the connection was, I think, in the minds of the people who chose it. Apparently did not think through the reaction that would happen when a teacher or a parent saw, my first grader is going to be, you know, or I am going to be required to teach a lesson about Jacob's first dress.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't use the term transgender. It doesn't say he wants to be a girl, but that is the hot button topic.
So who blew the whistle? How did this get out of the confines of CMS?
At least one teacher saw that lesson plan and said, oh no, this is not cool. And apparently, I don't know whether anybody went to a principal and tried to go through the chain. I think it would have been hard to penetrate that chain, but who they did go to was state legislators, state Republican legislators, who already have this perception that those folks in Charlotte need somebody to keep an eye on them because they're going to push this homosexual agenda.
So this is accurate, that the school board found out about this after the legislature was informed about this. Is that right?
To my understanding, it is. The way that Ann Clark described it to me, because I was this whole time, you know, as soon as I got word, as I think some of us in the media did, as this was churning its way through, as Charles Jeter was trying to sort of do damage control between these legislators saying, what are you people in Charlotte up to?
Yeah.
And he's trying to figure this out. They were communicating very poorly, but apparently they were trying to figure out where this was all coming
from.
So
on the one hand, we've actually had people on this show who have young children who are they identify themselves as a gender other than what they were born.
And that's a really important point. This is not some crazy fabricated thing. This is real life
for some young children. We've had these people on the program, these parents, and it's a difficult path to walk for them and for their children. And the children are sometimes bullied. So this book does have application in the first grade for these kids. And the purpose of going to school, it seems to me, is to learn about the world around you, which includes these challenges, these people as well. So how do you walk that line? Because a parent doesn't necessarily want their kid to know that at 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 years old. But then these kids get bullied. So how do you walk that line?
It's a difficult line to walk. And there are a lot of things going on simultaneously. And I think that's why this was all so confusing. Ann Clark came out and very publicly said, we are doing an anti-bullying policy. We have trained our staff. This was in August, and said, we've trained our staff to deal with LGBT issues. At the time, it included where transgender students would use restrooms or changing rooms. A lot of protests, some really vitriolic things said at a school board meeting. Moving forward now, the school board is updating its policy on multicultural education, whereas it used to say things like race and religion. They are now adding things like sexual orientation and gender identification.
Yes, the board is considering a policy to, quote, intentionally incorporate diversity throughout the curriculum, instruction, and professional development. Is that going to be possible in this atmosphere? Seriously? They going to be able to do that?
I don't know, and I think it probably should be discussed, because I think there are a lot of people in the middle who don't support bullying kids who are different, but who may say, I have real qualms about how you would intentionally incorporate LGBT issues into an elementary school curriculum. Mm-hmm. Now, whether those parents who want to sort of have a rational discussion about where the line is will be at a public hearing, or whether it will be, again, some pretty extreme people from out of town who showed up for some things in August, you know, I think this could get very messy.
Tom?
Well, just to follow up on the other half of your question there, when it comes to, I mean, the implied question is, will lawmakers allow CMS to do this? I mean, one of the things to point out is Republican lawmakers who support HB2 love to say, hey, but we are going to support anti-bullying efforts in all those programs in schools. So they use that as a way to say, you don't need to worry about bathrooms if we are in fact going to build out this anti-bullying campaign. So if it's done correctly, if they walk that tightrope, you can see the state legislature saying, yeah, that's good to go. But it really matters on how parents react to this, because parents, you know, you talk about how this book is just a life lesson. For some kids, it's directly their lives.
Yeah.
For others around them, it can hopefully educate them. But some parents will see this as an indoctrination. Some parents will see this as introducing ideas and subjects into their children's heads without their permission.
And yet another parallel thing going on is that the Time Out Youth is working with CMS to pilot a welcoming schools program, which is also focused on anti-bullying and how to recognize, you know, everything from whether it's, you know, your appearance or you're too short or whatever. It does come from an LGBT group. So the Values Coalition, which is the folks that are resisting this, are saying, again, this is indoctrinating. And this was what made it even more confusing, because the Jacob's First Dress is one of many, many books on the recommended reading list for welcoming schools. So I think a lot of people thought, oh, this is part of, again, whether you view it as a great life-saving anti-bullying program or an indoctrination
program.
But
isn't that a book that you'd be wiser to bring out if, in fact, you had in your classroom a child who was not identifying with the gender they were born with? Then you bring that book out and say, kids, here's the reality.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't know about that. I mean, one of the things that you could also say is, if our schools are there to teach our children, and if you're teaching children not just to react to a situation, but to learn before that interaction happens.
Right. Well, and as you said, the world around them. I mean, exactly. That's the world around you. I want to go back to something.
Well, that's the conundrum. Yeah. How do you do that?
I want to go back to something you said, Tom, which is that the Republican lawmakers have said they would support anti-bullying. They have said that, but do we have the evidence of them actually doing that yet?
And that's what I was trying to say. If this was done in a way that they liked,
yeah, I mean,
they walked
but that's
that
a big chasm.
It's a big
right
if.
There.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point.
And to sort of really pull up on this, I think whenever there are these district down, here's a mandated curriculum, I always think teachers are teaching anti-bullying and acceptance and how to treat other people every day in the way that they treat their students, in the way that they manage their classroom, in the way that they handle discussions of books. So in some ways, these let's teach everybody this lesson today in this way, I think, is much less important than, and there are teachers doing a great job of this, and there are probably teachers doing not so good job
Glenn?
Of it.
I think this conversation really illustrates the complexity of this topic. When I first read the headline, I was outraged. But as I read the article, I started to see some of the nuance. And for, as you mentioned, Ann, for some parents, for certain, it's not about whether you approach these topics. It's age appropriateness. Do you do this for an elementary school student, or do you wait for a later time? But if you wait for a later time, how do you train children early?
I think it was on Vice News last night, and there was a story about a fifth grade teacher, and I don't know where it is in the country, but there's a fifth grade teacher, and she has this game that she plays with kids in the class, where they have four corners in the room, and you have to go to a corner that identifies with your opinion when she asks a question. And the question she asked was, if somebody is using the term, oh, that's so gay, as a derogatory term, and you know somebody who is gay and they're a good person, what do you do? Do you do this, 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 or this? And it was the fifth grade. So under this political environment, would that be acceptable in CMS in the fifth grade?
I have no idea.
Okay. So the system is replacing this book that we're talking about, Jacob's New Dress, with a book about a blue crayon that has been mislabeled as a red crayon, but decides to be true to itself and remain blue. Is the symbolism on this going to be lost on first graders?
I'm not even sure that I believe they're going to substitute that book.
Okay.
I think that maybe Charles Jeter got a little out ahead of himself on that, because I think they were still trying to, they may have thought this was still part of the welcoming schools. What Ann Clark has said is that she has pulled back all of the lessons that are connected with the sexual harassment order from K to 12 to relook at them and make sure they're okay. I don't think the crayon lesson makes particular sense
context. When I read that story in the Observer a couple of days ago about the sexual harassment part of this, and I thought, what has that got to do with first or second or even elementary school kids? But then today in the paper is all this stuff that's revealed through the Observer's investigation about sexual harassment in the schools.
And it is mostly in middle and high schools. You know, I think they are talking about setting a tone, because I think probably everybody remembers things that happened in school that were not great. You know, boys are, and maybe not just boys, but mostly boys, you know, they start figuring things out and they put their hands where they shouldn't put their hands, or they say things they shouldn't say. So what they're trying to do is say you set this tone very early on that it's not okay to be touched in a way you don't want to be touched, or it's not okay to say things that make somebody else uncomfortable.
Well, we're going to move on because there's more CMS news. We'll save it for later. Getting the American Health Care Act through the House of Representatives has been a difficult slog. They may vote this morning. Do you know what time they may vote this morning?
I don't think they know what time they may vote this morning.
Okay. And the reason they haven't voted, they were supposed to vote yesterday, is because they can't get enough votes to pass the bill, and Republicans don't want to be embarrassed by this, and they certainly don't want the president to be embarrassed
by
this.
Although the president has issued an ultimatum that they will vote today.
I mean, this is
a vote scheduled for afternoon.
Okay. The last I heard was this morning, but they probably moved it.
Yeah. And this is one of those stories where I think it's really important to say, if you're listening to us live, we'll give you the latest.
That's
if you're
right.
listening to us on Saturday morning, you already know.
This
came out, because it's
so tell us what happened.
But several North Carolina lawmakers have been at the point of the spear on this. Among them, North Carolina 10th District Congressman Patrick McHenry, who joined us on this program on Monday.
When you have 237 Republicans in the House and the Democrats have declared that they will not participate in the negotiations on this, we have to figure out how do we get a majority vote of the institution with our Republicans. I have many of my conservative friends saying we're not going far enough, fast enough. And then I have moderates saying we're going too fast and the change is too big. So this is the push and pull of legislating.
Well, that might be true, but did Republicans think that it would be Republicans who would be standing in the way of the Republican dream of repealing and replacing Obamacare?
Well, obviously not, or they wouldn't have introduced the legislation and touted it so prominently.
Lipstick on a pig? Is that what that statement
is? Obviously, we've all watched this play out. I mean, they are scrambling furiously to figure out how to thread that needle of making the conservative side happy and keeping the middle of the road, and so far they've struggled to do that.
And you talk about Representative McHenry. You haven't brought up the other one.
Mark Meadows.
The thing. You mentioned that they're at the tip of the spear. I think
about to bring up Mark Meadows.
I think a better way to say it is actually they've got their pointy spears and they're pointed at each other.
Right.
Because you have McHenry, who is the deputy whip, which means his job is to make sure that the Republicans fall in line and vote the way that the Republican leaders want them to vote. And then you have Meadows, who is head of the Freedom Caucus.
The House Freedom Caucus.
Yep, so. Which is has about, what?
36 members?
Yeah, three dozen members. And they are they're basically the Tea Party wing. They are the Tea Party wing of the Republican mm-hmm. Party. And they really want things different than what the moderate Republican wing of the party want. And that's the reason they haven't been able to whip up all these votes. And that's actually why you had President Trump on one side and Speaker Paul Ryan on the other trying to corral these two almost diametrically opposed groups of Republicans
right.
to try to find this middle ground. And it's clear that they hadn't found it as of Thursday night.
Well, I mean, that group is the reason that John Boehner plays golf for a living.
That's true.
And Mark Meadows and his group went to the White House and gave President Trump a standing ovation in the cabinet room when they met. They know it's on television.
No, that's true. But the standing
then,
ovation,
Then they went back and they said, "We're not doing this."
Well, then that's the thing. I mean, look, politicians are savvy. They know that a photo op is a photo op. That's going to get the attention. They don't want to come right out and say we are in disagreement, open disagreement with the president of the United States, who hasn't even served out 100 days yet. Yeah. When that is a member of their party, so they're gonna say nice things. But at the end of the day, they're still not corralling the votes, and that's why you have Steve Bannon. The chief counsel to President Trump, Reince Priebus, and Kellyanne
Conway,
thank you, all going into a basement room of the Capitol building with the House Republican caucus on Thursday night and said, you either vote for this on Friday or we're leaving Obamacare. That's the president's word, period. And then they walked out. That is one heck of an ultimatum.
Glenn.
Well, first of all, I don't believe that ultimatum. I don't think there is anyone who seriously doubts that the GOP will at some point pass and the president will sign some type of health care bill. I think the question is when, and I think Nancy Pelosi and what she said yesterday was correct. It was a rookie mistake to try to set a deadline to pass something this complex. And they were so eager to do it on the anniversary of Barack Obama signing.
And he set a deadline for his health care to be passed, and he didn't meet it either.
And it took much, much longer to pass that one than it took to pass this one.
Right.
Well, I was just going to say, though, and here's the trick with that. And I understand your skepticism about the ultimatum, but it was still made publicly. So the president here is in a really tricky situation. The ultimatum went public. They made it public. So now, if it's not voted on today, it also questions his ability, and this is one of President Donald Trump's biggest, he loves to pat himself on the back about this, of being the ultimate negotiator and closer.
And I think the frustrating thing, too, is we see these pictures of the caucus, and you see the full range of wealthy white males represented in that room, and you need to remember that these are Americans who do not look like them, do not live like them,
right.
who are ultimately going to be affected by these decisions.
They made the Republicans tried 52 times under the Obama presidency to repeal Obamacare. They've had years to think about this, and they come up with a plan that even Republicans don't like, and even Americans for Prosperity, which is a political group funded by conservative donors, the Koch brothers, oppose this plan and have said that we will support those of you who may be hurt by voting against it. How come they can't come up with a plan?
Everything else was just practice. It was all meaningless.
Because they knew it wasn't going to pass.
And it wasn't going to pass.
But they've been thinking about it, haven't they? Haven't they been talking about this?
Well, I think they were thinking
really?
About no. politics.
What they've been
really?
Talking
exactly.
about
Glenn's
is
exactly
that,
right.
That what they've been talking about is we don't like this, not here's what we're going to do. And Tom's point is right. They're basically playing Jenga with cinder blocks right now, because if they don't get this health care bill passed through, then tax reform and all those other issues begin to melt away.
I don't even know what Jingo is, and that's funny. We're going to go into much more depth on the politics over the health care bill on this program on Monday at 9, among other topics. And we'll talk a little bit more about this. And
Mike doesn't play Jingo?
No, I don't even know what it is. But you'll tell me during the break. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Iron Yard, offering a full and part-time web development courses in Charlotte for career development. Enrollment is open. More info at theironyard.com/Charlotte. And the Original Mattress Company, providing mattresses and bedding hand-built in the Charlotte factory and offered direct to the consumer. More info at originalmattress.com. The Republican health care bill is coming down to the wire in the House. The Trump team's connections with Russia continue. continue to be under scrutiny and terror in London. Plus, Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch answers questions in his bid for the High Court. Just some of the stories that we'll be talking about on the National News Roundup coming up on Point with Tom Ashbrook in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. You can talk about some of the stories we're talking about right now. Reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at charlottetalks, and you can use the hashtag WFAE Roundup.
Every day when the news breaks,
the president's been forced to fire his national security advisor.
More water is coming over the emergency spillway.
There's two loud groups that are here that have gathered outside.
I heard someone yell, "Get out of my country." Then there was gunfire.
Locally, there have been 60 to 70 unauthorized immigrants.
NPR News is there with context and clarity through the first 100 days of a new administration and beyond. Listen every day.
News you can trust from 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of Q City Metro, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. One final question about this health care bill. It's been said that this really isn't a health care bill. It's actually a tax reform bill, and whether that's accurate or not, North Carolina Congressman Richard Hudson has said that without this bill, I don't know how you do tax reform, and he added that if the bill fails, it's going to have negative repercussions for all of us. This is the linchpin to tax reform in the Republican agenda, isn't it?
Yeah, and actually that linchpin got a lot weaker over some of these negotiations we've been talking about between the Freedom Caucus and the moderate Republican wing. And the reason for that is it all has to do with repealing basically the mandate that you buy insurance and some taxes on things like medical devices that are present under Obamacare. And what's fascinating is So the Congressional Budget Office made news last week when they scored the original bill, and score just means this is how many people are going to, you know, be affected in terms of coverage. This is how much it will cost or save the deficit, and they scored what was then the latest one yesterday. And what's fascinating about it is the same number of people will be off of healthcare rolls, about 24 million Americans, and yet they managed to lose a significant chunk of the deficit savings. So it's the same bill but more expensive.
Half of the savings.
No, not quite half. I think it's now by $150 billion.
Yeah, it was $337 before.
Oh, well, then close to half, yeah. And I mean, it's just – it's
be more than half.
It's really stunning. And so, you know, Congressman Hudson has come out in favor of this for quite some time now. When you hear any politician, regardless of the party, say this will affect us all, he's right. They're right. It will affect us in one way, shape, or the other. But that doesn't mean that the implied effect is, in fact, what will happen.
Okay. Quick touch base here on the Charlotte School of Law, because this week Jay Connison stepped down as the head of the Charlotte School of Law. He's weathered a pretty tough storm over the last month or years, a year, I guess. Why now? Why did he step down now? Nobody knows. Okay.
Well, no. I mean, honestly, the point is simple. It's the school is trying to rebuild trust with more – I mean, they say with the faculty, which I do believe is part of it, but more importantly with the U.S. Department of Education so they can start getting federal grant or federal money again. And
they're also switching their business model from a for-profit to a not-for-profit university. How does that help?
I don't know. And that I'm not sure anybody quite does, because they're still talking about what's called a teach-out plan, where they would basically partner with another law school, this one in the Northeast, to teach law classes as if they were closing down.
I wonder if the nonprofit move is a credibility move. In other words, maybe there's
PR.
Yeah, PR, you know, just saying, look, this is something that we're doing for the good of students.
And the change of deans could seem to be the same. They appointed on an interim basis Scott Broyles, who seems to be fairly popular with the faculty and the students. But the bottom line is still their enrollment is down to 220 from used to be.
So they're no longer – they're not really a for-profit institution anyway.
Yeah. You know how you become a nonprofit? You lose two-thirds of your enrollment. That's how you become a nonprofit.
So I think really the question is whether this is a long-term move to save the school or whether this is just sort of close out.
And evidently they're proposing to hand over the operation – the academic operation to an academic institution. And is it Infolaw that owns them right now?
They would just handle day-to-day operations.
Right. Okay. Moving on to the legislature. Glenn, the legislature wasted no time in overriding Governor Cooper's first veto. As a result, we will now know which political party the candidates running for judgeships belong to. The legislature says this will give voters helpful information. So then why did the governor veto it?
Well, I think the governor vetoed it because I believe he thought it was a bad idea. There are a lot of people out there who believe that these judicial races should be nonpartisan, that we should not interject politics into these judicial elections. But we got our first look at what will probably be divided government for a while when the governor vetoed it and the legislature very quickly, in a matter of days, overrode that veto by substantial margins.
And they also, one Mecklenburg County State Senator introduced a bill on Thursday that would split one judicial district in this area into three, allegedly as part of a move to make sure Republicans won't be disadvantaged in judicial races in urban counties.
I think that's where this is going next. Not just here in Mecklenburg, but I think in all of the urban areas, you're going to see the Republicans looking to split those judicial districts. Currently, there's one district, so it's kind of like an at-large race almost.
Right.
What they want to do is split them into sectors where they can probably get Republicans elected here. Others would be safe Democratic districts.
And this General Assembly has taken that approach with other elected offices, school boards, and county commissions and things. So this would follow that same
playbook. This is Senate Bill 306, and Republican Senator Jeff Tarte says it's straight up political,
yep.
Which plays right into the hands of Governor Cooper, who says the reason he doesn't want the R and the D next to people on the ballot is because it politicizes these races, and they shouldn't be political.
But when you have
votes. Shocked that he said that. I was shocked that he acknowledged that it was straight up political. We all knew that, but you don't usually hear that degree of candor.
And you have to give him respect for being honest about it. I mean, I do sincerely mean that. But there's, it's not just city councils and everything. If you actually look at what the Republican-controlled General Assembly is doing this year, it started in December. It's fascinating. They focused before on tax reform. They focused on what they call tax reform. They focused before on changes to voter laws. Now it seems to be the judicial branch is directly in their sights, and they're doing all kinds of things. Supreme Court races after the Republicans lost control of the Supreme Court this last election, suddenly it's going to be a partisan race again. Now Superior Court and District Court judges. They're talking about changing these districts. It is really a mass reworking of the judicial system.
At least
in this moment, we know that politics was and is a consideration.
Is there a danger here that this could blow up in their faces because there are more voters in urban areas which are traditionally more Democratic, or is there enough?
Not the way they're structuring it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, what this shows us is how powerful the General Assembly is in North Carolina, and particularly with that supermajority that they can override a veto, as Glenn said, just in a matter of a couple of days.
Meanwhile, we don't hear much about the lottery for education and how it's helping education, if in fact it is, but the governor wants to use lottery money to offer free community college tuition. He says this will be, quote, good for economic development and for lifting more North Carolinians out of poverty. Does he have any support for this on Jones Street?
I haven't seen anything yet. I mean, Democrats, obviously, yes, but I haven't seen anything. And to be clear, the governor's plan would make community colleges free-ish. And what I mean by that is the state would not pick up the entirety of the tab. What they would do is encourage the students with a minimum, I believe, of a 2.0 grade point average to then go off and get whatever federal aid they can get, and then the state would pick up the rest. And other states, Tennessee actually is a great model for this. They have a pretty similar system. And I have relatives who live in Tennessee, and community colleges is actually just seen as how people start college there, which is something we are seeing here in North Carolina. Be approached.
And it's cheaper to go through college that way. You do your first 2 years in community college and then go to a four-year institution.
Yeah, and in fairness, like in the Tennessee plan, which again is very similar, their program is coming in under budget. I think it's cost about $10 million last year, something around that. And it's under budget for what is planned. Governor Cooper says that it would cost probably more like $19 million here because it includes the startup cost for the program. But it is a really intriguing idea. And if the General Assembly looks to other Republican-controlled legislative bodies and not just the fact that it was proposed by somebody who seems to be these days their mortal enemy. Maybe perhaps we can see some movement on this.
So from a distance, Ann, we've been following Charlotte, the progress or lack of progress of Charlotte High School student Gustav Mudio through his interaction with ICE. He's an undocumented immigrant student who's been here under DACA. and he was arrested for what? Allegedly embezzling
$2,900 from Harris Teeter, where he worked.
And so that's a felony. He pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor. He's been held in a detention center in Georgia for, what, a month now, 6 weeks? And how did he get the charge reduced?
Well, they had this plea deal, and he ended up with what's called a prayer for judgment continued, which means that it's essentially a plea without a sentence. And if he were to keep his record clean for a certain amount of time, it would not be on his record. Mm-hmm. But his attorney is conceding that however this plays out, he's going to end up going back to Mexico. So now the question is, will they release him from the detention center, let him come back to Charlotte in a time in which he can complete his degree or his diploma, graduate from Northwest, and go back to Mexico?
Is that likely to happen?
I don't know. I have no idea how to predict what ICE will do. I'm not sure anybody does these
days. And the reason he would want his diploma is that would increase his employment prospects once he returns to Mexico, a place he hasn't been since he was what?
Quite young. I'm thinking five, but I wouldn't swear to that. And again, he has his family here. I think he would love to be able to see his friends and family. And it's worth noting that Harris Teeter was paid off in full by the school community and friends who raised that money because they really want to see Gus be able to come back and graduate with his class.
Something unusual happened this week. White suburban Republicans and black urban Democrats on county commission united in telling school board members that they don't trust the district to pass school bonds this fall. Why?
Well, there's sort of this annual rite of spring where the commissioners and the school board come together. And for anybody who doesn't know it, the school board doesn't have taxing authority. So the county commissioners have to allot millions of dollars to CMS for a good chunk of their operating budget. But this year, the bonds are in the mix. And it's been, I guess, since 2013, there was a relatively small bond package. Everybody agrees that the needs are real, that we need some new schools built, that some of the old ones are in bad shape. But the commissioners really weighed in with a range of concerns. They said, and a big one is this big question mark about student assignment. And you have people saying, we're watching this and we're really anxious about what it's going to do to our schools. So while that's an unknown, we're not willing to vote for bonds.
Can they float bonds without the county commission's approval?
No, it's up to the county commissioners to put that on the ballot. My guess is that they will. Some of this is always a little bit of posturing, but the most dramatic decision that the county commissioners could make is to say, no, not this year. We're going to come back after you've made your decision. We're going to come back after Clayton Wilcox has taken over. That's another one of the uncertainties that's out there is that this push is being led right now by Ann Clark. Mm-hmm. Clayton Wilcox has left his district in Maryland. He's actually sitting in the audience during this meeting and I think will be during a lot of others. That has really, I think, some of the turmoil that we're seeing in CMS is that leadership change that people aren't sure who's in charge right now.
And we're waiting. Okay, we have a lame duck and we're waiting for the arrival of the new person in July.
Right, and we're waiting for student assignment decisions, which is big. And you actually saw some of the commissioners almost doing the horse trading right there on the floor. Vilma Leek has been, her district is getting a good bit out of this proposed bond package. They do have a list of projects that they came up with in a more or less objective manner. And this always happens as somebody starts saying, and Vilma is saying, we need a new West Charlotte High School. We need a new Bruns Academy. And Elise Dashew, kind of on the floor, said, well, would you look at a bigger package if we added those? And they were, kind of looking around and going, would we do this? And people start saying, whoa, if you start jumping projects up the list, this gets really messy.
Meanwhile, this week, a 2015 report from the Federal Office of Civil Rights, which was sent to CMS 2 years ago, finally saw the light of day because the Observer fought for it to come out. What does it show? And why did it take so long for this report to be released? And did the school system act on it in quietly?
Well, and fought may be a little bit of a strong word here. This was part of this whole book thing. As we started hearing that it was connected to the Office of Civil Rights Investigation, I just emailed and said, is there an investigation? Please provide us all documents. And they did. So it was sort of one of those where it was like, we've been discussing it in closed session. If you'd asked for it, we'd have given it to you. So they provided it, and yes, they are acting on it. A lot of it is kind of internal stuff, documentation, faculty training, and it was this student education piece of it that led to the Jacobs New Dress. So it's been a complicated week in CMS.
Yeah, and there's also a big article in the paper today about sexual assault victims,
right?
Students, and there are lots of them.
Yes, they looked at 96 reports, and the 96, you know, included some that were not substantiated and some that were much more minor. But some of them did rise to the level of sexual assault on students, either by their fellow students or in some cases by teachers. So those cases are always disturbing. In some cases, they led to police charges and or serious discipline against the students.
Okay, so Tom, as the wrangling over health care continues in Washington, Raleigh announced that health care insurance premiums for state employees, teachers, some retirees, will be going up next year. Why and by how much?
Well, the numbers won't sound that significant to a lot of people, but it is significant when you consider the salaries that teachers make and the fixed income that retirees make. Currently, the state offers the state self-insures, which means they act as their own insurance company. And actually, the state of North Carolina is the largest insurer in the state. They currently have 2 0 premium plans. Those basically go away. One will people will pay $25 a month for individual coverage. Another one, you know, it goes up from $15 to $50. But the reason why is simple.
That doesn't sound bad to me.
Well, as I said, but you know, the what you need to think of is not just overall dollar amount, but purchasing power and what percentage this is of an individual's income. Okay. And the reason this is happening is because the whole plan is run by state treasurer, and Dale Falwell is the new state treasurer. And he went through and had actuarial studies done on the state health plan, which is pay-as-you-go. So General Assembly gets a bill. Last year it was $3 billion. They pay it, but they don't set money aside for additional costs, even though you know healthcare costs are going to rise. So right now, Falwell says that the state health insurance system is $42 billion, has a $42 billion with a B dollar unfunded mandate, meaning these are costs that we know we're going to incur at some point, but we don't, you know, we don't have the cash to pay for it. So this is an effort to try to shore that up and to, you know, minimize the overall impact, because if the way the state structures its payments, it first has to pay its bills before it can do anything else. So if you don't solve this problem, all those tax dollars get sucked up before they ever get down to things like roads or museums.
Before we started, I said we're not going to get to Eric's economic development stories, and we're not.
there will be another day.
But international soccer is not coming here this summer.
No, Neil.
Not connected to HB2, right?
Not connected to HB2.
Okay.
There you go. Play the birthday sounder.
All right. Eric Spenberg, Ann Doss-Helms, Glenn Perkins, Tom Bullock. Thank you all for the hour.